For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
So welcome everyone. I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here at Ancient Dragon Zengate, for those of you who aren't familiar with us. And I'm very, very happy to have Paul Disco here with us this afternoon to talk about his practice of Zen architecture, Zen designs, Zen building. There are copies of his book, Zen Architecture, in the back that he's kindly made available to us to sell as a benefit for the temple, so you can look at those afterwards. But they include pictures of some of the things that he'll be showing us and more. So Paul is a teacher and priest at San Francisco Zen Center, was ordained as a disciple of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, who sent him to train for 5 years as a temple carpenter. He ended up training for 10 years as a temple carpenter and designer in Japan, and has come back and he's built many temples and homes and other buildings in Japan, in California, other places in America and in Europe, and now works designing various projects. So we're very happy to have Paul here. He will be here tomorrow evening also talking about the difference between Japanese training and American training. And so he'll be here tomorrow evening at 7. So anyway, I'm going to pass this over to Paul.
Hello, everybody. Taigen and I were students at Zen Center with the same teacher. I was a little older than he is, but we came out of the same cloth and the same interest in social movement, social welfare, social how we live our life as a community, and how to make the best life for humanity, as well as how to understand the meaning of the universe. Anyway, I have no idea what you're going to see today because I haven't looked at it myself. These are a series of photographs that were taken that, and I don't know, my assistant put it together, so I don't think she did what I asked her to do, but she did something, so here's what we have. Anyway, In the year 2000, at the turn of the millennium, I bought a piece of industrial property in Oakland, California. It actually belonged to my father's second wife's sister and her husband, people that I'd never met, because my parents had separated when I was quite young, and I didn't even see my father. I saw him a little bit when I was 5, and didn't see him again until I was 55. So. Anyway, it's a long story, but anyway, so he came to visit me in my shop, which was 2 blocks from here, and he said, "Oh, my sister-in-law has a place near here," and I said, "Oh, how interesting." And then next year, she said, "Oh, they're selling it," and so I went and looked at it. I knew about the property. It was an oxygen plant where they made oxygen by compressing air and then bleeding off. Liquefying it and then bleeding off the nitrogen, just leaving the oxygen and the trace elements in it, and selling it. They ran the air through these big tanks that had lye in it, and the lye combined with the carbon dioxide and made bicarbonate of soda, and then the rest of the air was compressed and then liquefied and cooled, compressed and cooled and liquefied, then thereby liquefying it and then put it into a big tank where the pressure was set at a level at which the nitrogen boiled off, leaving the oxygen. but it was all defunct. It hadn't been operating since 1987, I think, was when it shut down. And they were just using it as a distribution point for other kinds of gases, and I think they'd hawked it to the hilt, and they'd run out of money, and so they were selling it. And since I was family, I got to first right of refusal. So there was developers wanted it. It's most of a city block, very close to the Bay Bridge, very, very nice location. But it was in a very run-down neighborhood where most people were scared to go. It had a bad reputation. I was telling it at lunch, it was the place where they dumped the bodies, not where they shot the people. So it was not really that scary, but anyway, it was left over, this wartime industrial area left over from the Second World War, and all the industry had changed and moved away, and lots of iron fabricating plants, iron working plants, very big iron plants, and they had built the Bay Bridge there, the San Francisco Bay Bridge there, the big iron bridge. Anyway, so it was sort of a no man's land, and it was very cheap, so I was able to buy it. Fortunately for me, it's changed. It's now the fashionable art district now, but it wasn't there then. Anyway, so I had this property, and I bought it just because I needed a place for my sawmill to go along with my woodworking business, and I didn't really pay much attention to the rest of the property there. I just rented it out to anybody that wanted to rent it and just to pay the mortgage. And then I, about 5 years ago, I started the process of retiring, of turning over my business to the next generation, and moving my headquarters over to this piece of property instead of the two blocks away where I had my shop before. I did various things there, but on a sort of a small scale, and then slowly I got the idea of building it up and making it a craft center. So the idea is that it's an ecological industrial park. So I have a number of different craftspeople there, and I'm building more space for more people. And last year we had a little open house, and a local brewery came and set up, you know, donated some beer, and the different craftspeople had their wares out for sale, and the guy that runs the sawmill now used to run raves, so he knew about bands, so he knew some band members. They set up on stage and had this sort of rather loud raucous band playing. But anyway, my design studio and my staff of my two other people that I work with had this little space inside of a container barn that I'd built to store wood in. We hadn't stored any wood in it yet. And they were going to serve the beer there. And my staff person asked me, well, what kind of plastic cups do you want to have? I said, plastic cups? You have to be kidding. We're not going to use plastic cups. And so then I had to come up with a substitute. So we have a country place where I'd planted mosu, the timber bamboo. And we don't do a whole lot with it. So this was the weekend before the open house. I went up there and I have a little wood shop there, and I cut down a number of pieces and set up the chop saw and just chop, 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 chop these bamboo stalks and made a whole bunch of these cups. And so I sold the cups for $1, so that when you had a cup, then you could get some free beer in it. So that way, and then you could take the cup home with you. You could take the bamboo cup home with you. So I'm also into fish farming as part of this. Circle of food, of waste and food circle, which I hope they'll be showing more of. I will see what shows up on the screen. But I also smoke some sturgeon, so I think I'm preparing the smoked sturgeon there for people to sample. Anyway, let's see what's next. I think she thought this was a very Zen picture because it's empty, ready for the empty vessel, ready for whatever comes next. So
a lot of the pictures are about all of the temple buildings.
I hope that's in there. We'll see. We'll see what's. I have no idea what she said, what she put in there. Anyway, so this one became. Let's see which one. This was white walls. This one. I think this one became the bug growing room. One of my tenants grows mealworms and crickets for snack food. And this is before she set up shop in there. It's a 40-foot metal container with insulated walls, insulated with a beaver board, with a soundboard walls, and ready for the bugs to arrive. Okay. Here we are. This is Tassajara. I've told this story in several different places already this visit, but San Francisco bought Tassajara in the early 1967. It was condemned. The property was condemned, and that's why they were able to buy it at an outrageous price. But that was beside the point. At an outrageous price for the time, 160 acres with hot springs on it for $300,000. Now it sounds cheap, but back then it seemed like a lot of money. Anyway, so the reason it was condemned was because the kitchen was condemned. So the county said that they would give us 3 years to build a new kitchen, and the old kitchen had its roof cut off, its walls cut off. It's just a deck. And on this deck, there was a small building, small, simple building, no bigger than this room, maybe not even as big as this room, but that's where all the food for 60, 80 students was cooked for the first few practice periods.
So we
set about. This unfortunately shows the finished kitchen, but we set about as the student, all student labor, and we were meditating in between. We were working like six hours a day, and we went about bringing stones up from the river and building stone walls. These logs were pine trees that were beetle killed on the mountaintop. Chew's Ridge is the mountain 5,000 foot peak that you have to drive over the top of to get to Tassajara, and it's way down in the valley beyond. We cut the trees down and dragged them into camp and sawed them up and did the roof structure out of them. And it was, this photograph is, that's electricity. We started off with just propane lights, and we had no electricity. So the hood was a convection hood. There was no fan. And that's why the chimney going out of it is so large. It was to create enough volume of air to make a hood over the stove. And the walls were the only thing that we hired was the tiling. We hired some tile setters, a family friend had a tile business that he provided the tile and a couple of German tile setters came, and the young fellow that was my age from the family. Anyway, that's a whole other fun story, but not important for this discussion. Now it was the question of being so isolated. It's like being in another country. It's so isolated from the rest of the world, and the tile setters found it a little difficult. Anyway, the counters were made out of the old form boards. The countertops are made out of a sycamore tree that had fallen down down along the river and was sawn up in a local sawmill in Carmel Valley. And the windows were of the style of the existing stone buildings that were already there. Let's see what else we have. And then, okay, so now this is the current Zendo, which was a replacement for when we were first there, there was the kitchen and then there was the dining room and the bar, and we turned the resort, and we turned the dining room bar into our meditation hall. And during a ceremony in 77, a fire erupted in the basement somehow magically, and it all burned down. And the county had insisted that we have a fireproof, a 2-hour firewall between the kitchen and the dining room and the zendo, which I fought tooth and nail because you can't make your own fire door. You have to buy one, you know, and we had very little money. And it was all DUI. We set all the stones ourselves. Did all that, mixed all the concrete. But fortunately, the county made us do it, so the fire was stopped by that wall. The kitchen didn't burn, but the meditation hall next associated with it did, and the library above burned. So anyway, so we set about, we needed a new meditation hall. We needed it in a hurry. So this was supposedly a temporary building that we built just a few months later. It was, I think it cost $7 a square foot, for some of you that know about construction. And it has no, it's just concrete piers, but spread out. This was after I came back from Japan, so I had some Japanese concepts of building, but it's part Western, part Japanese. Anyway, just set out on a 3x6 grid over the whole bottom of the building, so it's just many, many, many points of contact with the soil. And then we leveled them off best we could and put sleepers down, and then the decking, 2x6 T&G decking, goes directly on top of that. And then the walls were just 6x6 posts with a 2x6 top plate and bottom plate nailed onto it very simplistically. And we made homemade trusses to span it, just 2x4 trusses with plywood gussets. And it was all done with volunteer, not necessarily even woodworkers, just anybody that wanted to volunteer, volunteered to help build it. We built it in a very short period of time. Somebody made all the shoji, those are paper shoji screens. Let's see what else we have.
Before you go, if I may add something. This shows half of the meditation hall. This is the temporary meditation hall that Paul built in 1977. It's still the meditation hall that's used at Tassajara. I was there for a few years in the early 80s. Back then, all the lights were, all the lighting and heating was kerosene.
There's still kerosene lamps there.
You can still see the kerosene lamps there. Now there's this. This is a more modern.
This is more current. Yeah.
Electricity, but it wasn't there then.
Now there's also a ceiling too. It didn't have a ceiling. It has a tin roof, so when it rained, it was quite loud.
Well, when I was there in the early '80s, there was that wooden ceiling.
Yeah. They put in the.
But just to give you an idea, this is half of the meditation hall. So that altar in the middle.
It's actually a quarter of the meditation hall.
Well, there's this side, so that, yeah. Just so you get an idea of the space.
Maybe there'll be another picture of it if we're lucky.
Maybe, but that platform with the seats, there's another one like that over here, and then there's a whole other half here, and that's the central altar. But that temporary meditation hall built, that Paul built in 1977, still is the meditation hall.
And it was all built with ordinary wood from the lumber yard. It was no special wood.
But in the old days, there was no electricity. Back when I was there, we enjoyed inhaling and exhaling kerosene.
Well, there was no ceiling either, so it was kind of drafty. Anyway, let's see what else we have. Okay, now we've jumped to Marin County. This is the Wheelwright Center. This was a building that was partially built when I came back from Japan, and there was a very interesting fellow named John Ewall, who was a local builder, and he was building it. And it turned out that he was one of these pathological liars. He could not tell the truth for this. but he's a really nice guy and really generous. He would give you anything. It just didn't belong to him. And he sold the Zen Center all this wood for this building, but somebody else had given the money to buy the wood for a different project, and he'd sold it to the Zen Center instead. It took a while to straighten all that out. Anyway, so it didn't. When I got back, it didn't have a roof on it, and so I took over and developed this walkway and the roof and made it a little more Japanese. It's like a conference center room. It's a meeting room. That's a meeting room for non Buddhist activities or liturgical activities. And then there's a couple of apartments downstairs and the dining rooms downstairs. Okay.
So just to get to add, Green Hills Farm, for those who don't know, is one of the three main centers of San Francisco Zen Center. And that building is still very much there, and a key part of Green Hills Zen Center.
And then this was... this was a... At that time, the San Francisco Zen Center had quite a strong outreach, and Jerry Brown, the current governor of California, was the former governor of California. The first time he was governor, he was part of the Sangha, part of the community, and along with Stuart Brand, who had the Whole Earth Catalog, and Rusty Schweikert, the astronaut, and Huey Newton of the Black Panthers, and anyway, a number of these sort of oversized, super male characters that sort of had a boys' club of an exotic boys' club of ideas and energy got together, and they focused it around this Lindisfarne Fellowship, which was it was sort of like a New Age think tank, I guess, what you would call it. And they would bring in some very interesting people. A man named Keith Krishlow, which was into sacred geometry. He did buildings that had to do with the planets, the way the pattern of the planets make going around the sun. Anyway, and the state architect that under Brown, Sim Vandran. Yes, there you go. Was part of the boys' club, and he came up with this idea of an octagonal building with rectangles and triangles for a roof, and then I took it and turned it into a timber frame building, and then it went. Then everybody had an idea. You know, it was a community, so everybody had an idea, and it went through 13 iterations. And Krishna wanted it to be a certain kind of rhomboid. I forget what the terminology was that made so that it was. It was the same shape no matter which way you looked at it, you know, vertically, horizontally. But that turned out to be way too expensive. So it went. This is the 12th rendition, and Sim is not a builder. He's a thinker. So I did the construction documents for it, but we didn't get a building permit because we called it an agricultural building. And you didn't need to get a building permit for an agricultural building, but the county board of supervisors would meet in the building, and they would meet at the Wheelwright Center actually while this building was being built. And some reporter was digging for dirt on Jerry Brown, and he saw this building under construction, so he went to the county and asked to see the building permit, and they said, "What building permit?" So then we got red tagged, but I was working with an engineer, an Englishman named. Jeffrey, what was his name? Jeffrey, I can't remember now. Anyway, quite an interesting fellow. Being an Englishman, I'm dyslexic, so on my drawings I'd spell joinery with a T. Joinery with a T, and he wouldn't sign the drawings until I took the T out. So the English preciseness. Anyway, this was done by the crew of Zen students that I'd hired and I'd trained. That we were all students. We meditated in the morning. We meditated at night. We ate there. We slept there. We got $50 a month in room and board, so the time and money had no connection to each other, and we did some really incredible stuff. And it's mostly all wooden joinery. There's not any real serious metal in it, except for the shingle nails and stuff like that. Okay, let's see what else we have.
It's still there, it's wonderful to stay there. That's the guest house you're being
called. Actually, I went to a week-long meditation there last fall and stayed there for the first time in my life.
Stayed there a few times. Each of the rooms is eye-shaped, sort of.
What's next? This is the Abbot's house. This is this was being built for a wealthy entrepreneur who wanted to join the community, and he wanted to have a house there. So he said he would build a house. He would pay for a house being built, and he would live in it as long as he wanted to, and then it belonged to the community. So we started this project with our local crew. And we got sort of carried away, and anyway, we said we'll really do this one with no metal. So this building is, except for the very thin boards, this was all done. All the framework is put together with wooden joints. Up there on top, it looks like a skylight. That's a big solar collector up there. Had a whole hot water solar and hot water. The octagonal building did too. That was back when solar was the first phase of solar, very active solar. When solar was a big thing, when Jerry was the governor at the beginning, and then somebody figured out that you just put an extra couple of inches of insulation in, and you don't have to bother with all this crazy solar mechanics and everything. Anyway, so this had a big solar collector in the attic in the roof with this big skylight that showed into it. And it heated the water and heated the house, and there was a circulation system and all that stuff, which I think has all been disconnected now. But anyway, it's a nice building inside. And Reb, our teacher, Reb Anderson, lives there still. Okay, now this, unfortunately, they're showing the inside first. I don't know if I'm showing the outside or not. This is a Zendo that I built in Switzerland, in the mountains, in the mountain between Zurich and Lucerne. It's called the Rigi. It's a famous mountain. It has a cog. The first cog railroad in the world climbs up it. And Queen Victoria climbed the mountain in the 1850s. And it became very famous, because of somebody famous had climbed the mountain, and people would come, and there was halfway up the mountain, they built a hotel for people to stay in because it's a long climb all the way up. But about 5 years later, they built the first cog railroad, so you could go all the way to the top in about 45 minutes. The little steam-driven cog railroad went up there. So nobody walked up anymore, and nobody used the hotels. The hotels sort of sat there for 150 years. And by the time that my client and I came along, there was a stonemason had bought it, and he rented it in the summer a little bit for hikers. And he brought home all kinds of old machinery and old bricks and four of this and six of that and 12 of this. It was just a junkyard of stuff. It looked like Appalachia. It was just, and the Swiss were really pissed that the mountain was cluttered with all this stuff. So they were very happy when we bought it. But and we fixed up the hotel for it, had a Zendo there. But we wanted to build another proper Zendo. And there was an old barn on the property, but they started balking at us building something new, and they said things like, "We don't want any exotic buildings in our forest." And the Swiss are very, about as ethnocentric as you could possibly get. Anyway, so this was a building. This was a building that I built. Go ahead and see if there's any other view of this. There it is. Okay, that's a better view. This is the outside view of it. Anyway, built all, made, cut out all the pieces, pre-finished them, labeled them. Every piece had a number, and put it in three containers, shipped it by rail to Houston, boat to Rotterdam, barge to Basel, truck to Lucerne. Took it out of the containers, put it in 100 kilo bundles, took it to the base of the mountain in a helicopter, brought a pile of wood dropped out of the sky every 8 minutes. The Swiss are crazy about helicopters. Anyway, and then some of my guys and some local people stayed and put it together for, I don't know, 6 months, a year, 6 months, eight, 6 or 8 months. But all the pieces came from Oakland. You can't see it. It has a local copper. The walkway around the outside is all elm. This is a little out of sequence. I was working on the Ellison job at this time, and I had cut all these big elm slabs, like 2 feet wide and 5 feet long and 4 inches thick, tapered to an inch and a half at the other end. Anyway, for the Igawa, for the walkway around his building. And he had turned them down because he said they were too exciting. He wanted blonde or simpler wood. So they were left over. So I incorporated them in to this structure, which illustrates the point that a large part of the design was driven by the needs of the client, the location, but also what I happened to have in my warehouse. So I would look and I would say, oh, I got enough of that to do this. I got enough of that to do that. This is Port Orford cedar around the handrail, around the outside. That was all things that were not quite high enough quality for the Ellison job. The outside paneling is just local cypress trees from California. It's all either leftovers from another construction site or cut from urban logs. Okay, now this is a residence in Sonoma County. It's based on round posts, which is more Chinese than Japanese, and it's also based on the inside and the outside being the same level. So the inside pavers go outside and come inside. Metal roof is a corrugated metal roof, which is something I saw in Japan and liked a lot. It's painted with asphalt emulsion, as the Zendo at Tassajara was also done. Anyway, the asphalt emulsion is sort of gloppy and lumpy, and things stick to it. And so it takes that sort of shiny industrial look of the corrugated tin and it combines it with the sort of funky irregularness of the tar, and it makes a very nice combination, which is part of that whole design critique of having both form and emptiness of shiny and bumpy together. And I didn't want to have a slab. I really wanted the stonework around the outside and the inside to be, well, it would be nice if it was stonework, but the budget didn't allow stonework. So, whoops.
Sir, I thought it was my mistake.
Yeah. Let's go back again. That's a whole... Can you go back? Okay. So we accomplish this by each one of those squares, those three-foot squares. It's all based on a three-foot module. Japanese architecture is based on a modular system. Whatever the module is, you invent the module that you build it on. Whatever module is appropriate, and you create your own measuring instruments to work with that module. You don't work with the factory-made measuring instruments. Anyway, so each one of these was poured individually, and it's sort of a checkerboard pattern, so you didn't pour them one next to each other. You'd pour it in the morning, and then by the time at the end of the day, it'd be hard enough to trowel before you went home. So that's why they're all a little bit different. Anyway, I was trying to get away from that homogeneous, monolithic look of a concrete slab. And the doors are sort of metal shoji screens in the sense that they all fold back with the accordion back. But when I did this job there, they didn't have a commercial folding doors that came later. And so the metal fabricating friend and I invented the system of folding doors, of folding metal doors. Okay, now let's jump to the... So then this was the building I was working on while I was doing the Swiss project. And this is a 6,000 square foot house in three pieces on a 4-acre lake on a 25-acre piece of property in Woodside, California, behind Stanford, for the owner of Oracle Computing Company, the mainframe company, for the owner Larry Ellison. Anyway, it was a 10-year project, and here again now this was another situation where time and money had no connection to each other, just like in the Zen Center, where we were working virtually for free and we didn't take care how long it took. He didn't care how long it took. He didn't care how much it cost. He just wanted it perfect, which is also a great stressor because you have no excuse. You know, the usual contractor excuse is, well, I know it looks a little sloppy, but we ran out of money. Or, well, we had to hurry up because we ran out of time. There's no escape. Anyway, so that the far building is the kitchen, the entry Ginkan, and the kitchen and the great room, and then this walkway between that thing between the two is a 8-foot wide walkway that goes between the two buildings, and it's sitting on something you can't see, which is an underground passageway between the two buildings, underwater passageway. And all these buildings have a 12-foot deep basement up against the pond, and the guy that's in charge of the carp, could not possibly have his carp swim in the pond water. So there's a shutoff underneath that walkway that keeps it from merging with the pond water on the opposite sides. But it looks like it's just like that last house that had the two ponds, the fish pond and the swimming pool, with a bridge over it, and a hidden divider. This one has a hidden divider. It keeps the pond water and the fish water separate. Anyway, no expense spared. And this is a view of that same building from the other side. Yeah, question? Somebody asked something, I hear? No. Anyway, so this is the great room. It's 36 feet square. It has no walls on three sides. And for the architects in the crowd, you'd say, well, how did you do that without any shear walls in a seismic zone? And how we did it was by having a 12-foot basement and all those posts cantilever up out of the basement to hold up that roof. And that little cupola on top, in a traditional building, that would be the smoke hole where the live fire smoke would go up through the room and go out through the ceiling, up through the roof. But I used it as a mechanical chase, and all the chimneys and vents and everything come out of a hidden space on top of it. So all those are sliding glass doors, and then there's an open on three sides, and the pond is about 6 feet deep of the walkway. That was the walkway that Elm was supposed to be on, and then we ended up doing Alaskan yellow cedar instead. And I'd come across this guy, that fellow from New England, that had studied boat building in Japan, and he'd done a tugboat, tarobune. It's called tarobune. Anyway, it's like a big wash tub, big wooden wash tub that the people that know for pearls and shellfish used, and then he'd also built with the last remaining boat builder in Tokyo this nori bune, this they used to go out and collect seaweed in Tokyo Harbor back before it became so polluted by modern industry that nothing grows there anymore. But that used to be a big source. They had big seaweed farms there, and these little boats would go out and collect it and take it back and dry it and sell it. So it's all, it's a traditional boat. I also built a 24-foot boat for this lake that had a, he wanted a boat with a tatami room on it. So I built this boat with a two-mat room in the back. He likes to have resting places to entertain his lady friends. So that was it would hold 14 people, though. There was space in the front, a little electric trolling motor to turn it around. Okay, let's see what else we have. Okay, this is a building. This is a loft in New York. This is on the seventh floor of what used to be a music publishing company in the East Village of New York. It's Astor Place, where the Bowery ends and Fourth Avenue starts, and Seventh Street comes into it on the side. It's Cooper Union. You look out the window, you see Cooper Union. Look out that way, you see Cooper Union. You look the other way, you see the Empire State. And this is probably the most traditional Japanese building that I built in America. We were planning on having a growing garden inside, because I figured, everybody's growing pot inside with lights and everything. Why couldn't we have a regular garden inside with lights? But it turned out the ex-president of Columbia lived downstairs, and he was always with these two large men with bulges under their armpits, and we didn't really want to irritate him especially. Either we're going to overwater it, it was going to leak, or we're going to underwater it, it would all die. So we decided that stones were probably a safer way to go. But this is about as traditional as you're possibly going to get in any country. Okay? So this is O2 now. This is the compound. Where it says Soba Ichi, that's the restaurant. And then my design shop's behind it. And then there's that... Sotuba, what we call the Soba Milling Company. And that's that little barn where the first picture of me and the bamboo cups. And then the one other side of it is the worm growing area. And then in the back, the insects, there's a Japanese, so's Japanese traditional clothing downstairs, and more greenhouses for bugs upstairs. And there's blacksmith back in the corner, and the iron fabricator, and the Juniper Ridge is essential oils, and then Atelier Dion does ceramics, and then I have my aquaponics fish and greenhouse, and then the Den Sake is a micro brewery for sake. A fellow that he was a sake salesman for a long time, but he decided he wanted to actually make sake, and he found a fellow in Japan that would help him teach him, and he comes over and it helps him out. And so we've had our first sake from there just this last couple of months. Then there's the Ponderosa Tree Service is the tree service that took over the sawmill, so they cut up urban logs. And then it's actually says Lucas Ford, but actually he's doing something, he's a wood salesman now. He's not making stuff out of wood anymore. There's a couple of other, his partner's still there. There's a couple of other young woodworkers there. And then there's another greenhouse that aquaponics set up for a restaurant that I designed in San Francisco that's called Perennial, where the idea is that all the waste from the restaurant comes back here and is fed to fish, who then poop in the water and feed the plants that are growing in the water, and the plant life goes back to the restaurant. So it's making it a full circle. And then I have my food, my my food, my what is it, I don't know what it says there actually, but anyway, I had my animal food from industrial waste kitchen there, and then there's a stainless steel fabricator in the tall bay there, that does, you know, breweries and wineries and kitchen equipment. And then the next building, they call themselves woodpeckers. It's about six or eight young woodworkers that do. They're like art school trade more. They do more arty kind of woodworking. But they build stuff for me that I design. Right now they're building a treehouse. They're building a treehouse I designed that's three stories tall. It's actually a house in the shape of a tree rather than a house in a tree, although it is attached to trees. And it's all made out of, it's supposed to be made out of redwood branches and redwood bark and willow. And anyway, it's very whimsical. Anyway, they're just finishing that now. And that's their workshop. And Top Leaf is a fellow that grows farms the tops of buildings. We went to a place the other day. We went to that where they had the garden on the roof. Did you? I guess I went with somebody else. Would I? Where was that? I don't remember. We went to lunch. Uncommon Ground has a garden on top, but they just have like a raised like a bench with some plants growing on it. This is like the whole rooftop is dirt, and they grow plants there anyway. So he has his nursery here, and that's so he's getting that going. That I have a little vegetable garden, a little vegetable farm, chickens there as well. I have four raised beds and a chicken house that fits on top of each of them, and I rotate it around to fertilize the ground, and the chickens fertilize the ground, and then you can grow things like French intensive style, like very close together. So this is the main thing I'm doing now. So a lot of it is based on using things that other people don't want and recycling things, and then small scale production of things that people can actually use. And is there any more? Is that the end? Yeah, that was the end, I think. Anyway, that's a very quick overview of 20 years. Anyway, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Why don't you go back to that step? We'll go one step back there. Can you find one step back?
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So this is what I'm doing now. It's based on the concept of Motainai, which is not to waste. It's a Japanese concept, and that there's a woman that got the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, I think, in Africa. I never can remember her name. But I think she's from Kenya. Whose slogan was Motainai, of reforestation and working with rural people in Africa. Anyway, it's a concept of more of not wasting. It's more of respecting all things, not just to throw stuff away when you've had enough of it, but to take it and use it and see that it has a final home. So all the food from the restaurant scraps, all the restaurant scraps go to the chickens or the fish, and then to compost, and then back to plants again, or to the black flies. So, yes?
You mentioned moving your chickens around and doing some kind of a French...
French intensive? Okay, I came across this first with a fellow at Santa Cruz, taught at Santa Cruz, Alan Chadwick. He was this rather flamboyant gardener. and he later came to Green Gulch and farmed there. But he started out at Santa Cruz, and it's just the idea is that you build the soil up so it's so strong and so much nutrients that you can plant vegetables right close together. So like when he grew, he would take an area about maybe a third or a quarter of the size of this room and layers of various different kinds of compost and chicken manure and things. And then he would plant carrots like a lawn. So the carrots would be like a total lawn in the whole area. They'd have enough, there was enough juice in the soil to support that much growth in that smaller area. And they would grow wheat that same way. They'd grow wheat right, so the stalks are right next to each other. And all a wide variety of things. And I always thought it was sort of a good idea if you didn't have much space, you might as well plant things close together. And so the chicken house, there's raised beds. The chicken house is just the same size as the top of the raised bed. So as things mature and are ready to be fallowed, I move the chicken house onto them and then turn over the ground and plant where they were last. I don't have a picture of that here, but that's where that area, right in there is. Anyway. Anything else?
You guys have a well on that side of the place anymore?
Wells are illegal. I wouldn't have a well. No, heavens.
So you have sanitary connection as well.
Was that? What's in the plans, and I don't have it here, is a whole water processing plant of aerobic and anaerobic water processing to break down mostly it's ammonia, break down the biomass and turn it into a nitrogen product that the plants can absorb and then purify the water for reuse. So it's on the drawing boards. If I had more money, I would have built it by now. But
so you also have a teaching facility aspect to this.
I want it to be that eventually. It's still a work in progress, but I that's my hope, that it'll be a teaching facility just to show that it can be done and that other people, my hope is that other people will take the idea and duplicate it somewhere else and they will have, it's the Buddhist concept of right livelihood. They will have something they can do that they are directly related, they're directly participating in. It's not alienating. It's good for the environment. It's good for the community. And it's good for your mental health. So that's my hope, but you can only social engineer so far. But definitely the water processing is a big part of what I want to do there. But,
and I'll make just one other comment.
Yeah.
Where the connection is made between integrated lifestyle or environmental money lifestyle and impact maybe on individual mental well-being. That's a rare connection right here. I don't often hear that.
I guess it's my leap of faith. If you enjoy what you're doing, and you're doing with people that you enjoy being with, it's very conducive to mental health. And you're eating something that's healthy, and not overstimulating, not chemically bound up. I mean, it's just in a low stress environment. I think that's. Makes for a lifestyle that's sustainable, but it's hard to force people to be good. That people don't necessarily like that. So I'm trying not to force anybody to do anything. I'm trying to create something that they will feel comfortable doing on their own accord, and if they aren't, they don't have to. And that's right in front there now, where there's just some funny little pyramid things. I have no idea what the artist thought that was. Maybe it's writing. I don't know what they... I thought there's a bunch of stones stockpiled there. I guess that's what it is. My next project is to build a three-story building using this. It's called mass timber. It's cross-laminated timber paddles. Have you come across that? Cross-laminated timbers? Anyway, there's this, I'm a big believer in wood. I like trees in all different aspects. I like to grow them. I like to cut them. I like to build with them. I like to sleep under them. I like everything about trees. And they have the advantage of they make oxygen for us to breathe. And then when you utilize their material, it sequesters carbon, and it also creates energy for the production, for their production. And right now, the industry has promoted this LEEDS concept. I mean, I'm sure you've come across LEEDS. No, out here, LEEDS, here you. Anyway, LEEDS, it's this totally phony bullshit thing that the industry has come up with to make the dirtiest possible building methods somehow ecologically green, make them green. So it's steel, glass, and concrete. The three dirtiest processes known that the man has ever invented, aside from nuclear energy. And they create mass amounts, they utilize mass amounts of fossil fuels to be created. And they don't give back anything. But they are green. They are considered green by the industry. And they this whole sort of hype thing about LEEDS Platinum and LEED certified. You can pay a lot of money and get LEED certified if you're an architect. And anyway, it's I find it repulsive. But anyway, but so this mass timber is trees that are sustainably grown, that reproduce themselves, and enhance the atmosphere in the process, and you can use it just like concrete. But no steel, so it's just big. It's like big sheets of plywood that are 10 feet wide, 40 feet long, and up to 8 inches thick. And the panels are just like plywood, are glued together with like 2x6s, and they're sawn lumber, and glued up. And then they cut them by whatever shape you need for your building, and they deliver them, and you stack them up. You stack them up either vertically, or horizontally, or both. Anyway, so I'm building a building with that technique in that space there as soon as I can get a building permit. And it'll have a rooftop garden, and there'll be rooms for processing pre-industrial kind of foods like baked things, flours, oils, fermented things, charcuterie, pickles. Anyway, a lot of the staples that we still eat and that we used to eat. Yes.
I'm curious about how this particular group of artisans come together to form this community.
There were some people when I started putting this together. There were some people there I had to encourage to leave. There was a pot grower there that actually ended up shooting somebody, and the cops took him away, so that made it easy. And there was a couple of brothers that used to work for me, and one of them went a little crazy and was living in his shop and drinking a lot and going out and starting fights on the street and stuff. I finally got him to move along. Anyway, but mostly when I meet people that I think are really great people and I encourage them to come, and if they have money, if they have a business already going, like the iron fabricator in Juniper Ridge, they just move in. If not, I build out space. I said, like the sake guy has no idea about how to build anything. I mean, it's not his realm. So I build out his brewery for him, and then I prorate it over a period of time and charge him rent. So it's to facilitate him moving in. So it's just whatever, depending on the person and the process, and I only facilitate people I think that'd be an asset to the community, but it can be a wide range of people. It's just all depends on who comes along and wants a place. There's a fellow moving in, probably moved in while I'm here, who does biogas from bio waste digestion and making a methane gas for cooking, small scale. There's some people that want to do the aquaponics things on a small scale, so people can have it in their backyard. There's the whole compost operation going on with the wood waste and the waste from the essential oils creates a lot of they every year they grind up several truckloads of unsold Christmas trees and steam all the essence out of them, and then that waste is used for compost. And I'm hoping somebody, because that's sterile biomass, that'd be perfect for mushrooms. I'm hoping to find somebody. I run into people that want to do mushrooms, but you have to do more than just want to. You have to actually, you know, eat, sleep, and make love with mushrooms. But it's starting a business is not easy. So
your barn there, is that made out of a couple of containers?
There's 4 40 footers, and then behind that he didn't really capture in the straw, there's 4 20 footers. And then I just bought some trusses, some wooden trusses, and put them up top and covered them with corrugated tin. Very, very quick and easy. And I had the containers already from various different things, and they were getting a little funky, and the roofs were leaking and stuff. So this way, it keeps them dry.
Do you ever have trouble with the fish eating the plants?
The what?
Any trouble with the fish eating the plants?
You know, that just happened just recently. I have the fish down below, and the plants up top. The plants are like 6 inches of water, the fish are like 3 feet of water, and they go through a biodigester and then into a pump, and then the water goes up to the plants, and then it goes through the plants and drops down to the fish again. So it's a continuous loop. But I got nervous about mosquitoes in my upper pond, so I bought some little fish. They're called rosies. They're kind of fathead minnow that they off a strange version of is pinkish. So, and they're sold as fish. They're sold as live fish food, you know, for bigger fish. What do they call it anyway? And they also have the little teensy goldfish. They're also being sold for the same purpose, to feed bigger fish, and they're 10 for a dollar. So. So I bought about a dollar's worth of both of them, and I put them in that upper part. And I figured, well, they'll eat the mosquitoes. I won't have any mosquito problem. And then, like a year later, I'm cleaning out up there and moving around, and I see this animal running back and forth in the shallow water, and we have to take everything out, and we finally trap it. And there's these goldfish that are like 8-10 inches long, that are really fat. And when I take the plants out of their floating beds, there's no roots. The fish had eaten all the roots off, and these little fish had grown up big and gorged themselves on the lettuce roots. Anyway, it was a living situation. But the fish, you can't have fish in the same bed with unless they're so small or so are not plant eating fish. Okay.
I got to just mention one other thing. You know, you had earlier referred to a building that Sin Vandering was involved with.
Right.
The octagonal-shaped building at Green Gulch. And he was associated with Jerry Brown also.
Right. He was a state architect, yep.
That group has had a significant influence on national building codes as regards energy conservation.
Yep.
The creation that they experienced as a team or as an association with one another has had enormous impact.
Yep.
National building for the last 20 years. So something maybe that might be viewed as obscure and small, as that might be, has been enormous. Now, Chicago's an outlier as regards its building codes, but the national codes that you have to comply with outside the city are impacted by what occurred on that site.
Yeah, well, California is the leader in a lot of things like that. Yeah. And I'm hoping that what I'm doing will be, I'm not you know, I'm not Jerry Brown, so I don't have a big screen to shine on. But I'm hoping that what I'm doing will be an inspiration for other people to do the same thing. And it's I get these enthusiastic, you know, the thing in California is this disruptive economy, and people want to come in and find some new idea and build it up, and then perfect it, and then scale it up, and then sell it to some corporation, and then move to the south of France and drink themselves to death. I mean, that's sort of the syndrome that goes on in California now, and some of the hippest young people they think that way. And I keep telling them, no, we don't want to scale this up. We want to duplicate it again somewhere else. We want lots of decentralized production, not centralized production, for power and for the needs of daily life. So I'm hope that, I mean, who knows? I mean, I just, we have an expression, where Thay can go. We have an expression in Buddhism: when you're the head student, and you have your graduation ceremony. When you're the head student, some of you may have seen this, and there's a shuso ceremony, it's called. So you are the, for a practice period, you are the head student, and then at the end, you sit up on the dais, and all the students ask you questions to test your knowledge, or to try to trick you up, or try to see whether you've learned anything or not, or unlearned something more precisely. And we always say, though my understanding is like a mosquito biting an iron bull, I'll do my best to answer your questions. So this concept of mosquito biting an iron bull is the way I see this here. I mean, it may not come to anything, but I'm going to bite anyway. Dragons and elephants, lend me your ears. Though my understanding is like a mosquito biting an iron bull. I forget what comes after that, but anyway. Yes?
What effect has this had on the community around it? You mentioned it was sort of a scary place for people.
Oh, it's already turned into an art community. It's you see attractive young people in skimpy clothing running down the street. It's totally changed. It looks like Andersonville, where we were the other day. Yes?
You talked a lot about living in the buildings in time. Can you talk a little bit about the mindset that Japanese workers have in building a building and the tools they use and how that's...
That's what I'll talk about. I'll talk about that more tomorrow. Because that's that east-west. The east-west difference is something that's very. I think it's very pertinent to how Zen is transmitted to the West, and the way that craft is transmitted is a very similar thing. And I don't know what the answer is, but I know what some of the questions are, and I wanted to discuss it with people. I was going to do that the next tomorrow, right? What time? When?
Tomorrow night, there's a meditation at 7:15, so around 7:45.
Tomorrow evening, okay. Yeah.
But speaking of Japan, though, is there anything, do you know of anything comparable like to this in terms of experimental programs? Looking at sustainable businesses and so forth going on in Japan now.
There's more and more young people that have been disconnected from their cultural roots that are trying to rediscover their ways of farming and their way of making things and so forth. There is a movement in that direction. And I don't know that much about it, but I am aware of it. The sustainable part, I don't know. There's various people doing various things for various different reasons. The fellow, the basketball player in Milwaukee that's doing that whole thing with the underserved community of Milwaukee with vegetables and fish and so forth. I think he's doing that just to give people a job and something to do and an income stream, and it is ecologically sound as well. But I don't know which, you know. I think the culture, building the culture, is more important than the ecology. But I have no idea. I haven't been there, but just read about it. But I mean, there are places like that, and there are lots of little, you know, neighborhood farms and stuff that are trying to do various things, but. I'm trying to recreate a whole microcosm here, which is a little bit of a reach.
So in your general creative process, do you prefer to carefully plan out your projects and then execute along that plan, or do you prefer to sort of sneak it up as you go along?
It has to be both. You have to be wide open. As you know, I take my cue from Dogen and the Genjo Koan. You have to let everything inform you. You can't, if you bring your idea to the project, a completed idea to the project, it doesn't necessarily go well. And I have one of those that I can talk about that don't have time to talk about now or voice to talk about now. But if you enter something and listen to what all the different factors, that the people involved, the space, the time, the money, all those things, then the project pretty much designs itself. And you have maybe a style of what you're, you know, if you're composing a song, you have to decide whether it's country or pop or classical or opera or whatever. So you have maybe have a style that you're composing within, but after that you have to put all the different pieces in. And then once you do that, then you have to schedule it and plan it and organize it and think ahead and especially this style of construction, where every piece of wood has a number, it has a location, it has a style, has a shape, and is pre-made away from the site and then brought to the site and assembled. So there's a lot of organizing and planning that goes involved in that. But there's a system for it. It's like math. You don't just sort of randomly take a bunch of numbers and try to order them. You know, it's just like algebra. You have a form that you put things in. But on the other hand, at the same time, you have to let. And then if things change and are you come against a dead end that you didn't foresee, then you have to be readily available to reconsider it and head in a different direction. I was just doing a project, working on a project now down in Portola Valley behind Stanford. They wanted to do a wellness center, and they had all these rooms there, and yoga and wellness center for this kind of Japanese kind of shiatsu and moxa burning treatment, and they wanted to do a commercial space, like a doctor's office, and the city said no, it's not zoned for that. It's only zoned for private residents. So we said, oh, okay. Let's see that. This treatment room will be called a bedroom, and this area here will be called the kitchen, and you know this. And we just renamed everything and changed them a little bit, and now we're doing a private home that'll work, function very nicely as a treatment center. We changed some of the shapes and a little bit of the emphasis. So you have to be ready to let go, and at the same time. I think I will close with this because...